Okay, this is review of communications, tape number 5, United States Coast Guard Cutter Itasca, June and July 1937. This is side 1 of tape number 5, and we're interviewing Thomas J. O'Hare, Chief Radio Man, retired United States Coast Guard. We are in tape number 3, side 2. We're about halfway through side 2. Of tape number 3, made May 20th, 1976. And I'm going to back up to where I asked O'Hare about anything left in his mind, any questions about what happened during the Amelia Earhart case.
What seems to be up in the air to you about...
Nothing. Earl ran out of gas and splashed. One sentence.
What questions are left unanswered in your mind?
Why she couldn't receive me. Was it me or her receiver? I'm inclined to think it was my transmitter.
Can you think of any reason why?
It wasn't modulating. We had had that trouble previously.
When was that previously? I don't know.
The thing was an erratic thing on voice. Because I remember once telling Leo that modulator is haywire. So he'd go over and do whatever it was he was doing. It was a minor defect that could be taken care of quickly, you know. But as I say, it was way down in that corner. And when I press the mic, it apparently is working. You know, you get the carrier and your receiver, the proximity of the transmitter. But I always thought that we weren't actually clean now. Otherwise, why would he have gone over to it that morning and made an adjustment? So there's two schools of thought, her receiver or my transmitter. And then she could hear me on 75. But you explained that. That she was going to the loop. That's about the only thing that ever...
Was there ever any question?
In my mind, why the hell couldn't she hear me?
Did you ever talk to Cipriani at all?
No. During the search, Cipriani, we left him on the island. See, we shoved off and didn't bother with anybody on the island. And Cipriani was the only one on there. So we could spare him.
He was second class, and you guys were all third class.
Yeah, but we were all superior to him.
Did the three of you third classmen, being that you were ship's company, get in any sort of a hassle with
him? Oh,
you?
No. I mean, he was just another warm body as far as we were concerned. Come up and relieve the watch, and that's it.
You never heard of him again?
No, never had occasion to. Never had occasion to.
What, do you have any opinions about why he couldn't get a bearing?
Well, he wasn't knowledgeable about the equipment. That's one thing.
You don't think he'd been trained previously?
Oh, heavens, no. He never saw the damn thing before, and I don't believe he even asked a question. Perhaps Leo did say this is that and that and this is this.
But he was
the type that wouldn't ask, how does this work?
How did they know what voltage batteries to hook up to the dump thing?
Oh, well, that's a simple thing.
How's that?
Well, when the gear was delivered, we're going to ask what the power supply is. God, when you buy a TV, you know damn well it's going in the
according to the deck log, it was just dumped on board.
No, it was delivered in Honolulu.
Yeah, but it was just brought aboard.
And taken to the radio room. By whom, I don't know. But it was in the shack. I saw it. And, of course we know it was a 6-volt supply. 12-volt batteries weren't in vogue in those days.
And you figured the gun batteries were 6-volt batteries.
Yeah, I thought they were high capacity, but according to what I read there, they were low capacity. I don't know. I can't offer a comment on that.
You looked at his logs yesterday. What?
So much garbage as far as I'm concerned.
You don't think those were actual logs that he made up at the time?
No. Of course, they're copies. And those copies were made in the radio room of the Itasca at some time, unbeknownst to me. He probably... The custom was for the radio operator to type up his own logs while on watch. You know, if there was any copies to be made.
Do you remember him standing any watches going back on Honolulu?
Strangely enough, no. Of course he did. But going back is a blank. I don't remember a thing about going back. I remember the search. But I don't remember going back to Honolulu. I have no recollection of going back.
By the way, was the position number one, was that on the port side or the starboard?
Starboard side.
That was on the starboard side. The position number two then would
be on the port side.
So the T-10 was on the port side.
You're right.
And the T-16
on the starboard side.
And the T-14?
Is in the middle, midship.
But aft.
No, I could reach out and touch it.
Well, that was the T-4, wasn't it, right in the middle?
No, that's on the table here.
It's up above. Well,
here I am.
Yeah. You're sitting on the starboard side.
I'm facing port side. There's the port side.
You're facing forward, aren't you?
No. I'm not facing forward. Well, here's my mill.
The radio room went athwart ship.
Yes. I am facing the port side. I want to turn on the transmitter.
Excuse me.
This is a swivel chair.
You have me confused now because the
Here's the way the chairs are.
All right, but where's the table go?
The table is running the length of this room.
Well, where does the room go then? You've got to orientate.
I'm going from port to starboard. Huh?
Okay, and so it runs the table runs the port ship also.
Yeah, here's the table.
Okay, you don't face the table then.
That's running the length of the shack.
Okay, got it.
This is the passageway. This is the walking area.
All right down the center. Okay.
Name is Whip.
Yeah, slippery there.
I'm entering the radio room from the port side. Here's the T-10.
Okay, it's aft.
Mm-hmm. Well, on this, well, yes, naturally aft of the table. There's the knife switch.
Right over the top of the T-10.
Right.
It's on the port aft corner.
Here's what's the 14 and 16.
It's right in the center aft. Okay.
Yeah, here's the 14 or the 16, whatever. And here's the other one.
On the starboard aft corner is the T-16.
Right.
Okay.
Here's the table.
Okay.
Here are the receivers.
Okay. The receivers are up.
There's a bank of receivers.
Are they all the same low or some up above the other?
One is above the other. Two of them are above the other. Two up and two down, I would say.
Okay.
Here's your switches for your transmitter.
Okay, they're right.
Here's the microphone. Here's your glass top table with your cue signals and for whatever you need.
Right.
Here's your seat, which is a swivel. Here's the typewriter.
Okay, the typewriter faces...
Fortship.
Fortship. Okay, it's not on the table. It's
no, it comes out from the table
from
on
the table.
A board.
On a board, okay.
And it's bolted. Now,
right.
Now there's one behind me.
Okay, so he's actually on the starboard.
All right, here's my log. Joe Blow has a message from
me. Typewriter behind you.
Joe Blow has a message. NMC has a message for me.
Okay.
Go ahead.
He says on the key.
I turn around.
Now he's facing the starboard side.
And I've got the message.
No, not the message.
I take the message out of the mill.
Right. Take the message out of the mill. Typewriter.
And I service it. Or if I hadn't typed the service. Then I put my log receive number one from NMC SRS.
Clock. Where is the clock located?
Yeah. It's got to be over there.
Right here. So you can both look at it.
I can't remember exactly. Generally, the clock is facing the operator.
But how about this operator?
So then the clock's got to be there, huh?
Clock is on the forward bulkhead in the center.
Over the T4.
Over the T4, okay.
Yeah, that would be it.
So you look up the clock, see what time it is?
So both operators can see. So it's 20 after.
Okay, so you write in your log that you receive the message at 20 after.
I ring the buzzer. The messenger comes down.
The buzzer is forward bulkhead.
Wherever, it's at the operator's position. Zoom.
That calls a messenger from the bridge.
He comes down. This is on a clipboard. Now I got it on a clipboard.
Uh-huh.
He goes around to the various departments with the six copies.
Wherever.
One to the bridge, one to the captain, one to the engineering officer, or whoever. Then he comes back with the original or any extra.
All initial.
All initial. They then go on my file. That's the radio room file, which is the original. Captain keeps his. The exec keeps his. The OD keeps his. And I'm sitting there for 4 hours or 6 hours.
You know, your microphone is on the table facing
that. Here's the mic.
Okay. Now you're going to transmit on the T10. You just sent a message to MNC on T16.
Yeah.
Now you're going to transmit the T10.
All right. Here's the buttons.
You press forward. You press the button for the T10.
All right. I just used the 16. All right. I killed it.
You killed the 16.
I push up. Now the T10's going.
Okay. And that turns on the filaments and gets the generator going for the place.
Yeah. It's dead.
Okay.
I wait a couple of seconds for it to warm up. What am I going to use, the key and a microphone?
You're going to use the microphone.
Wait
a minute, you've got to do something.
Nothing.
You've got to change the antenna from the T16 to the
T16. Oh, well, that perhaps.
You get out of your chair, walk clear over to the port side, throw the knife switch up over the top of the T10, come back, sit down, grab the microphone.
Blah, blah. Okay, I'm clear with whoever
you
I...
You forgot to throw the knife switch.
Not yet. I'm still using the T10.
Okay, but I meant before you used the T10, you forgot to
throw the knife switch. Oh, well, no, I did.
Okay, it's 40 years later. You wouldn't...
No, I wouldn't forget it, no.
Okay, now you want to send on key. You want to repeat the message using code now.
On the same frequency as I use
yeah.
this? Just reach over and key it.
Just reach over and key it. But how do you... Don't you have to rock back over the transmitter and
see no.
the voice?
When I hit the button.
You hit the button
that
on the microphone, it makes it automatically voice.
Yeah.
And if you send
when as soon as I take it off the button, it's back on CW.
Are you sure you don't have to throw the switch over?
No.
What if you wanted to send MCW instead of CW?
I don't remember one instance in my entire career that I sent MCW.
You never used A2.
I never used MCW in my life.
Actually, T16 wasn't even capable of it. It was strictly an A1 transmitter. It didn't have a tone modulation at all.
Well, I never used A2 in my life.
Okay. Not even for sending out homing signals?
For nothing. How many times do you send out homing signals? That was the only time in my whole life I ever sent out a homing signal.
You send out those homing signals on 500 kill cycles.
500? You don't send out homing signals on 500. You keep that 500 is a distress frequency.
You didn't send them video on 500?
I probably sent her a message. But I certainly didn't.
You don't think you sent it on A2 then?
Oh, heavens, no.
Sent it A1. So if she didn't have her BFO on, she couldn't have heard a thing.
And I would have to send it in dots and dashes, naturally.
And she would, if she hadn't had a BFO switch on, she'd heard nothing but a bunch of...
Perhaps. I don't know. I don't know what she had.
Okay, well, you had a typewriter in front of you and behind you then.
Mm-hmm. That one behind me is for messages.
And so, actually, the two operators almost faced each other.
He's facing me. Galton's facing me.
And he's on the
He's over
side.
There where the facing the starboard side. I mean, the talkable range.
So he would use his left hand mostly.
He would tune with his left hand. I would tune with my right.
And that's why the number one position was on the right-hand side, because you'd rather use your right hand.
Well, that was the main position. That's the one that was the operator's position. We seldom used number two.
Where did all these officers stand over in the room?
In the aisle between the transmitters and me.
Well, they'd be in the way then. Every time.
No, I'm sitting down.
Every time you want to change that antenna switch.
Move a little.
Every time you wanted to switch from
yeah, or second position would do it for me.
There was a door on both
sides. On both sides.
Were they open? You remember?
Yes.
Were they Dutch doors or?
No, regular doors.
And that would give you good ventilation in there.
Yeah.
Hot in there.
Yeah. They had a door on each side.
What kind of lighting did you have?
Well, you have one of those goosenecks right over your log.
You did?
Yeah. In addition to overhead lights.
And you could move that around?
Now, the gooseneck was right on your log, because at night, you turn out all the overhead, and the shack was dark.
Except for that.
As a rule. In the regular course of events. So the only light that would be burning would be the gooseneck over your log.
Okay, that's all that was on side two of tape number three, and that was the end of the interview that was done on May 20th, 1976 with Thomas J. O'Hare. I have one more tape, and that was done on December 31st, 1977. We'll get to that next. By the way, the reason the voices are quite low in tone there was because the recorder that I was using the playback on, batteries are kind of running low. If anybody wanted it back up on proper frequency again, why they just have to run it with fresh batteries in there. Okay, this is the final tape as of this date that I have on O'Hare. This is February 21st, 1977, and it's a short tape, and it was done on December 31st, 1977. It was done at O'Hare's apartment at 110 Southeast New River Drive in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, apartment number 8, and it is just a short tape, and it has on it where when I bought the original messages over to him, and at the point where we'll pick up here is where he is telling me about having lost the logs.
That's too bad you lost the logs. That's a shame.
Oh, that broke my heart, because that had it. Bill and I. See, Bill was backing me up. But
that's too
it was
bad.
I that had the horn.
All right.
Leo didn't have the horn.
We'll come in and talk for a minute.
Leo never had the horn in his hand.
While we still have the sun out there, and take a couple pictures as soon as you finish your cigarette there.
See,
okay?
The boy in the seat, I don't care if he's third class or a chief, he is the man.
Man.
Even the captain.
Right, at that time, he's the man.
When you're in the seat, you're the man in command. Leo never got the horn. There was only one guy that spoke to Amelia on 3405. What was it?
3105.
6210 double.
Right. Good harmonics for the antenna tuning.
Where do you pick up all this?
Of many years of study, Tom.
I know, but this is radio.
Yeah, but
how do you know it's the first harmonic?
I used to be an old radio man. Back in the Navy.
How fast could you go?
Well, maximum. I used to be able to send on a straight key about 25 words a minute.
I went 60.
I believe it.
Receiving.
You spent a lifetime at it, and I only spent a few years.
What a... You haven't got that horn down, have you?
No.
Well, I'll put it down now.
Okay. I was at...
I'm not far behind you. I've just turned this thing on. I'm 50 now. Young
oh,
punk,
boy.
Huh? Tom, when we talked before a couple of years ago, and when I talked to Leo Bellarts, when I talked to Leo, we taped the recording, we taped our interview and everything, just like you and I did. And when I was talking to Leo, Leo said, we made a mistake out there, and as soon as everyone's dead and gone, I'll leave a tape with my son or something and tell what it was. But I don't want to do anybody any that's still alive any harm or anything, and so...
Well, it wasn't we the operators.
No, he was thinking mainly, I think, of
himself.
Himself, perhaps.
He made
but
the
he
mistake.
But he didn't do that. He didn't leave anything with either one of his sons. I checked with
See,
him.
Leo should have been in the shack. And he's down sleeping. And there was no problem, you see. She's coming in fine. She's not answering me. I'm giving her the weather every half hour. But, I mean, there's nothing to become alarmed about from an operator's standpoint. I didn't become alarmed till she said, I'm running out of gas. That's when I hit the button. Down came Baker. Leo was up by this time. I said, this poor little girl doesn't know where the hell she is. I never could understand Noonan. What the hell was he doing all this time?
He was trying to navigate.
The world's greatest navigator in that particular line of work. As a matter of fact, he was a ship's captain, wasn't he, at one time?
I don't really know.
Well, I'm a little
foggy. It claims the newspaper said.
But he was...
He had experience aboard ship, I guess.
Well, I'm not the world's biggest navigator, and I know nothing about aircraft. But I'm a fair navigator. I can take celestial sights and as a hobby, like music. No, don't get me on music.
Yeah.
I go on that subject, I go crazy.
You forget everything.
I forget everything.
Yeah. So what did Leo say about the T-10 then?
He didn't say anything.
He didn't say anything?
No, he covered it up. Of course, I'm sitting there watching. And it's not my job to criticize the chief.
But you both knew it wasn't modulating?
I knew.
Well, you know, they...
Bill didn't know. Bill's back is to it. See, and I'm... Bill is facing this way, and I'm facing this way. Oh, I wanted to tell you about... I go off on tangents. See, and I'm... Bill is facing this way, and I'm facing this way. Oh, I wanted to tell you about... I go off on tangents. So I watched that Amelia Earhart story on the TV, and it was the most boring thing till I got to the ITESC. Here's the guy in white. He's first class on the right arm. I mean, we didn't wear whites, and radio operators don't wear their...
Yeah.
You wear it on the left arm. So when she went down, poor operator was heartbroken, as I was. And the silly thing, he reaches over and turns off everything. And slumped in the chair. The most ridiculous technical.
Yeah.
Honey, when you're in an emergency, you don't turn off your equipment. We went to 6210, Bill and I. Because I had a half a dozen receivers.
Of course, that's the T-16. Transmitter.
No, she said she was going to 6210. Yeah. I'll repeat this on 6210. You've got it in the
log.
No, you got it in that big message. Well, honey, we immediately went to 6210, not leaving 3105. So Bill's on it, I'm on it, the chief's up there going crazy, knowing that he's in trouble. They never did find that out.
Well, it shows in the logs, but no one ever studied the logs. Not your logs. It shows in the logs of the listening.
Why didn't they? Now, we should have banged Honolulu. We should have knocked him right off his seat.
Well, they heard your carrier, but you weren't modulating.
That's what I'm trying to tell you.
It's this mysterious...
Why didn't everybody in the... Why didn't Samoa hear? I'm knocking him off the seat there in the diddly-daddies.
Every once in a while, you'd modulate a little bit. They'd pick
up
one
word.
Yeah,
well, we had that trouble on the modulator. And it had to be adjusted. But the poor operator can't see it. He don't know.
Back to it, huh?
No, it's on the other end of the shack.
Oh, it's clear on the other end.
And when you push the talk, you think you're modulating.
Because the dynamo motor would start up.
Well, you can hear yourself. You know, and you think you're getting out. There's no way of knowing unless you look at the dial.
You got to watch the grid current.
And you think you're getting out. There's no way of knowing unless you look at the dial.
You got to watch the grid current.
Which we do automatically if it's sitting in front of us.
But it's behind you at the other end. You can't see it.
What was the one sitting on the table? T4?
T4.
Yeah. So when did Leo notice that it wasn't modulating? When he came down into the radio?
As soon as he came up the shack. But it was too late then.
She was already down?
No, Leo was there before she was down.
But they didn't know why. They couldn't understand why she wasn't hearing them. It took them a while to figure it out. It took a day or two to figure out what was wrong.
I knew right away.
Well, you kept asking. You asked Honolulu. It's in the logs. How do you read me? And he said, well, I hear her, but I can't make her out. But I don't hear you at all. It's right in the log. And you turned around and you asked American Samoa, how do you hear me? And he never did in the logs. He never really answered you. And you kept asking NMC to give you a check on 3105. And NMC came back and said, impossible to hear you.
See, I would ask him on Diddly Dad. Yeah.
Now, you could use the T16 get right
through. Oh, bang, no problem.
Bang, no problem. But the T16 was the problem transmitter. The one that was on, the only one that could transmit voice.
I will.
The explanation, then, for the mysterious carrier is the Itasca is the mysterious carrier.
It wasn't modulating.
Well, then, the reason you weren't hearing the mysterious carrier, because whenever it was on, you were transmitting.
I'm talking. I don't know what the hell's going on with this.
You know, the radio logs at the listening station in Honolulu show this. They didn't hear you, except they catch a word once in a while. The thing would break in a
on again, off again, it's hitting
it. And then the
we should have knocked him right off the stool.
Well, but you did after you fixed it.
After Leo got up there.
Then boom.
Leo knew that damn thing was erratic.
You were having trouble with it before?
Oh, many, many times. And Leo, being the boss, that's his job to
check that.
Well, that's his job.
Yeah.
When I'm the chief, I see everything is going fine. Then I walk out.
Well, do you believe that?
When I'm the chief, I see everything is going fine. Then I walk out.
Well, do you believe things would have been any different?
What difference would it make?
Not really.
And Cipriani's the guy that screwed up the deal.
Well, you know, how did he know how fast those batteries were going to run down, though?
That's a lie. That is not true.
But what do you think happened with Cipriani?
Cipriani was a dummy.
He just didn't know how to work the equipment?
No, and he was too stupid to ask. Had it been me, I'd have said, Leo, how does... I never saw one of these things in my life. Let's take some dummy runs. Show me. That's no disgrace. But Cipriani, he was second class. Christ, he wouldn't have made a good striker. He was afraid to ask. He thought he'd demean himself or somehow or other. But had it been me, how can a battery run down in a couple of hours?
Well,
they were fully charged gun batteries.
Were they fully charged, though?
Before we put them in the boat. They were fully charged.
It was a 35 ampere hour battery.
They were the heavy duty ones, yeah. You know, with the high capacity. What, he had two of them? But he didn't know how to run the damn breadboard, see? Neither did I.
Well, you know, the Navy offered to send an operator with it.
No. As I recall, I was at the gangway when it came up.
Well, that's right.
They bought, it was a breadboard, we call them breadboards.
Richard Black.
Dick Black.
He brought it aboard with Daniel Cooper.
No, he did not. The Navy drove up in a truck and left it at the gangway, and I happened to be around the gangway. And Mellon was the OD. He says, put that in the radio shack. So it was a small thing about the size of that table. The top.
I see, about 14 Whatever. Inches wide and about...
And it was what we call a high...
5 inches long.
C-3105 was considered high frequency in those days.
Did it have a variable tuning receiver, or was it crystal controlled on 3105?
I don't recall.
Okay.
But it was
an open... Leo did tell me. He told me when they brought the unit back aboard the vessel, they found the loop was not on the slip rings. It was wired, and somebody turned it around so many times, busted all the wires off the loop.
Well, that was Cipriani, I guess. Cipriani was the only guy that monkeyed with it.
And that was the end of the interview with Thomas O'Hare. Okay. In thinking about a couple of things, one of the things that was intimated by, I remember, by Admiral Black, and also, we're going to review the Sutter tapes, we'll see, but two or three people told me that the ship, they'd put the direction finder ashore, and the ship had circled around the island or something, and the direction finder had been taking bearings on the ship in order to calibrate it. Not to calibrate the ship's direction finder, but to calibrate the HF direction finder once it was ashore. And I couldn't reconcile that with the logs of the ship, because, as you know, the ship's logs, every time the engine's turned or anything, it's right in the logs. And in no time, in the ship's logs, in June or July before the Milliard incident, can I find any case where the ship cruised around the island taking these bearings. I'll check into that again, but it seems that Cipriani went ashore and they had never tried the direction finder before that. Or at least I can't reconcile the fact that other people had told me that they thought the ship had circled around for the purpose of calibrating the HF direction finder on the island. The ship's log would have to show that, because any time that the engines change RPMs, anytime the ship picks up a course, why, it's right there in the ship's logs. The other thing about O'Hare's tape this time, 2 years after the fact, the previous tape, we didn't, as you can, it was a short tape, we didn't go into great detail, but he seemed much more positive about the modulator not working than he was before. However, I think we went into it in much greater depth in the previous tapes that were done a year and a half before, back in May of 76. And as far as reconciling those statements with the logs of the listening station in Honolulu and the listening stations at Pan American at Midway Wake and Mokapu, it seems that the problem wasn't fixed right away after Leo came up. Either that or the problem continued on. Okay, that's the end of the Thomas O'Hare tapes, and I think next I'll do the William Sutter tapes. One other little point. The direction finder must have been a variable frequency receiver, because he did take bearings, he said, on frequencies above 3105, so he must have had at least some delta tuning capability. Just what the range of the direction finder was designed for, I don't know, but it must have had some flexibility and frequency variation. Okay, now back to the William Sutter tapes. Captain Sutter, who was an ensign aboard the Itasca at the time, William L. Sutter, was a communications officer on the ship. And as far as the officers were concerned, he was in charge of the communications directly under the captain for the ship. And I interviewed him twice, the first time in June 1975, and then again in July 1977. There are two tapes for the first interview and two tapes for the second interview. So we'll start out with the June 1975 tape, and this was done in his office in New York City.
And W.L. Sutter, Tuesday, 24th of June, 1975, we're on the fifth floor of the National Maritime Union at 346 West 17th Street, New York City, Manhattan.
Do you have a phone number at the office here at all?
Yeah, that's the number. It's area code 212.
212.
675.
7323. And it's 5 minutes to 11. And Captain Sutter's been nice enough to give me a few minutes this morning here. And we're talking about the Line Islands and the part that he played and the Itasca played in settling the islands and colonizing them in the mid-30s. Also, we won't have much time to get into it, but about Amelia Earhart and the part that, sensational part that she played in the Line Islands in those times. We were talking about engineers on the task at that time, and one thing that came to my mind that I haven't been able to put my finger on, someone said at one time, the chief engineering officer on the Itasca was a full captain.
No, he's a full commander.
Full commander.
Commander P.G. Eaton.
P.B. Eaton.
E-A-T-O-N. He's dead. He later became chief engineer of the Coast Guard. He was an admiral.
Oh, he was an admiral and chief engineer of the whole Coast Guard.
It was rather an odd situation. At one time, we were divided. There were engineers and line officers. Frankie Kenner was junior to Commander Eaton. He just stole the captain of the ship. Kind of an odd situation.
And were you on the ship when Eaton was the...
Yes, I was on.
May I get a little bit of your background? First of all, where and when were you born?
August 17, 1911, at Erie, Pennsylvania.
1911, and where, Pennsylvania?
Erie.
Oh, Erie.
Yeah, Erie.
And you're a Leo then?
Right.
Okay. Wait, when you graduated from high school, then did you play sports or anything? Anything?
I played football, and I was manager of a baseball team in high school.
And you graduated from high school, I'm guessing 29.
Right.
You're better. You know, I see now how these careers all start. People all kind of follow the same general pattern. How did you happen to go to the, did you go to the Maritime Academy, to the Coast Guard Academy?
Well, I started in 31. I worked at Erie Foundry for a while as a wood pattern maker. And I had a brother of my grandmother on my father's side who was in the Coast Guard. He had been, the Coast Guard originally was the Revenue Cutter Service and the Life Saving Service. He was in the Life Saving Service part. And they went together in 1915, so he was a chief warrant officer, so he kind of bent the twig.
Showed you how it was done, helped you along. Well, you went to Canada, then you were a class of 35?
35, right.
I see, and did any of your classmates at that time serve with you in the Line Island duty?
Only Mellon was young.
Mellon was a classmate of yours?
Yes, sir.
And...
By the way, he'd said earlier that he'd graduated from Central High School. He went to grammar school and graduated from Central High School in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Anyone else in your class that would be interesting to tie to? Is anyone who was later commandant or in any way?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. How big was the class in those days? Because that was right in the middle.
32. 32.
That was right in the middle of the Depression. The competition to get in must have been fierce.
The attrition was rather high, too. We started out with 78, and only 32 graduated.
78 to 32, less than half.
We were there, actually the first four-year full-time class graduate. Previous to that, they don't have a three-year course.
But you did go for 4 years.
Four.
When is graduation? Is it the same time every year?
No, I think we graduated May. Now they've shifted until early first week in June, I believe.
So May 1935, you and nice new ensigns with fresh new uniforms left the academy. And what was your first duty station?
The Itasca, both of Nell and I, our first job was on the Itasca.
And it was stationed in Honolulu at that time.
Right.
How did you get from the academy to the, and how long did you get a little leave before?
Well, we were granted 20 days leave after graduation. And Rola. Used to call them Rola.
Rola. Because it rolls so
much. Yeah, it rolls so much. And, so we report in the same day.
Now, see, did you get little leave?
Yeah, we had 20 days en route.
Now, somewhere along the line, you got married, but this was later.
Oh, I didn't get married until, let me see, 1940.
And so both you and Mellon at that time were both bachelors then.
Right.
And you don't remember any particular leave at that time going back to the Erie, Pennsylvania, spending any time?
I did once. We used to come back to the States once a year and for an overhaul and also annual inspection. The inspectors come aboard and we had to perform fire drill and boat drill, and they would check our accounts and how we cheated. Then we went up to Mare Island, and I took, we were in there, I think, 30 days, but I took 3 weeks to leave over in Mare Island and went back home.
Oh, and you went clear back cross-country again?
Yeah.
Which was quite a trip.
Right, in those days, I think it was...
5 days?
Yeah, it was about five days across. Yeah. You didn't have
air conditioning.
A lot of no air conditioning on our trains.
I didn't know your office air conditioner either, been the more of a sport for the tidy day.
No, there's no requirement.
It's a hot, muggy day here in New York today. We probably had some thunderstorms late this afternoon, the way it feels. In May. Well, by the way, was there any such thing as class standings?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what your class standing was?
I was number four.
Number four. Do you remember Mellon by any wild
chance? That I don't know.
Okay, that was the end of side one, tape number one. I'll flip it over to side two now. It wasn't much on there that had to do with the Amelia Earhart case or communications. We were mostly talking about Line Islands, and there was a lot of early Line Island information on there, but not pertinent to a review of communications. Okay, this will be side two now, tape number one, William L. Sutter.
You explained why you went to Jarvis first to take advantage of the equatorial currents going towards Holland Baker, because it did stretch your range to do these things in case of emergency. Why
you
would have been critical. And we mentioned that how you stood up off the island during the night, and you mentioned that even that the Shoshone had run aground one night. Luckily, it got off without any undue stresses, but. Would you describe one more time what the usual procedure was of standing off and coming up in the morning?
Well, we worked all day because everybody wanted to get home. I think on an average the trip would take us 27 to 28 days to go to all and unload. So we'd work till sundown, and then we would turn off our engines, because normally drift we'd have to use our engines to come up to make the whole trip as short as possible to the landing. We shut down, and as I remember, the current was about 3 knots with a westerly set. And so between then and daylight, we'd drift off maybe 25 to 30 miles. So shortly before daylight, then we'd get steam back in the engine and start making another approach on the island, so we'd be there shortly after daylight, after the crew had had breakfast and we'd all set go to work. But we did that at all the islands. It's a westerly set there, and it you get north of the islands, oh, a couple hundred miles, and you have the counter-equatorial current, which made navigation rather difficult. As I say, with these two curves going 180 degree opposite direction, that in the islands having such a low profile that sometimes, occasionally, we would miss the island. I think it happened once or twice, and we'd have to wait to get sunlight and go back and pick it up again. But you were mentioning, as I say, we also, one of the trips, we went to Samoa, and on that trip, Commander Brown was the commanding officer that I previously mentioned. But that had nothing to do with the Line Island project. And on that trip, Commander Brown was the commanding officer that I previously mentioned. But that had nothing to do with the Line Island project.
What was that all about?
Well, Samoa was not supposed to be have any war material aboard. I'm not talking bombs. Like they had constructed several large tanks for fuel oil. After a certain date, this treaty was signed.
Over this tape now, this is the end of side one, tape number 5.